Good afternoon. It's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bechtesh.
And I'm Elise Thatcher. The end of the legislative session means bills are biting the dust.
We failed to address the long-term structure and whether or not we can live within our means.
This week saw a changing of the guard in Carbondale.
Well, when I first heard the news, I was very surprised.
We ask, does the residential real estate market define Aspen's character?
Depending on how those internal documents that the city is not a party to are structured, it could really limit the types of commercial uses that are allowed.
And Pitkin County approves its first edible marijuana manufacturing license.
That's coming up on Mountain Edition.
The Basalt Town Council has formally approved a contract to build a Highway 82 pedestrian underpass. Construction could start in late August.
There's a few more steps before workers can start moving dirt. At a regular town council meeting Tuesday night, Basalt Town Manager Mike Scanlon says that includes
the communication piece, which is really the most important over the next 3 months, so that businesses, the residents, the school district in particular are all on the same page as we move forward.
The more than $7.1 million project will be built by Grand Junction-based United Companies, owned by Oldcastle Southwest Group, Incorporated.
Carbondale hosted the 2016 Colorado Creative Industry Summit last week. Aspen Public Radio arts reporter Patrick Fort has more on what went down at the event.
Along with some nice weather and full attendance, the summit went off without a hitch. That's according to Amy Kimberly, the executive director of the Carbondale Council on Arts and Humanities. She's leading the charge to get the town designated a certified creative district. Kimberly's main takeaway from the summit was that Carbondale shares common goals with creative districts across the state like Salida and Telluride. Carbondale should find out next month if it joins the ranks. It would be eligible for state funding if selected. For Aspen Public Radio, I'm Patrick Fort, reporting from the Edlis-Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
The Aspen Airport Business Center will now house an infused edible manufacturing facility.
The Pitkin County Commissioners reviewed the application for the Cannabis Queen to become the first edible marijuana manufacturer in the county. The company, formerly called the Sausage Queen, is looking to add cannabis-infused bison jerky to its offerings. After more than a year of review and red tape, the business is now ready to ship marijuana to the facility and extract oil from the plants to infuse the jerky in-house. No marijuana will be grown in the facility, and no odor mitigation should be needed. One concern of the commissioners is the close proximity to the Aspen Sprouts childcare facility, located in the neighborhood. But County Attorney John Ely said there is wiggle room within the 1,000-foot setback requirement.
It is not an automatic grounds for denial. It is a factor for the board to consider.
The council voted unanimously to grant the business a one-year operating license.
The Aspen Art Museum could end up in front of City Council in the coming weeks to hash out how it can host its Art Crush fundraiser in August. Patrick Fort has more.
Last year, the museum closed down Rio Grande Park in Aspen for 9 days to hold its Art Crush fundraiser, an event which cost thousands of dollars to attend. This year, the museum asked for 10 days and was denied, not once, but twice. First, by the city's special events department, and then by city manager Steve Barwick. The second denial was explained by Barwick in a letter sent last week. Barwick writes that he can't, quote, accept the assertion that the event itself is a community event. It is listed as a private event on the application, and there was no indication that the event is open to the public in general, unquote. The process of special event approval works like this. First, a group will send an application to the city. It outlines safety measures and a description of the event. It goes to a committee which includes police officers, city representatives, and members of the special events team. City officials say the impact on the park last year was larger than they had anticipated. Representatives at the museum say they received the city's denial and are deciding what to do next. Museum CEO Heidi Zuckerman declined to comment on the record. The city is preparing for an appeal. If that happens, the application would be reviewed by City Council.
After 5 months, Glenwood Springs has a new city manager. The City Council made the decision Monday.
Deborah Figueroa will be coming from Pennsylvania, where she's assistant manager of the Carlisle Borough. That town is reportedly more than 18,000 residents, more than twice the size of Glenwood Springs. Figueroa will start in mid-June with a 2-year contract. In a press release Monday afternoon, Glenwood officials said she is well-equipped to handle challenges like the Grand Avenue Bridge. Figueroa will take the place of interim city manager Andrew Gorge, who's been at the helm since December. He replaced longtime manager Jeff Hexel.
Local, state, and federal water managers have formally decided to allow another release from Rudai Reservoir in the coming months.
Several agencies have signed a lease coordinating a release that could start in July. The last one generated lots of complaints, especially from anglers who struggled with high flows in the Frying Pan River. This year's release is designed to be lower flows over a longer period of time. Linda Bassey is with the Colorado Water Conservation Board.
The fact that the lease amendment has been signed by all parties and approved by the state means that the stage is set for the Fish and Wildlife Service to notify that releases are needed.
That's to help out 4 species of endangered fish downstream. The terms of the release are the same as last year, allowing between 6,000 and 12,000 acre feet, but managers will work to keep flows between 250 and 300 cubic feet per second. Managers will make the final decision once they know more about snowmelt and other key environmental factors.
Major support for Aspen Public Radio's environmental reporting comes from the John Denver Aspen Glow Fund at the Aspen Community Foundation, promoting responsible stewardship of the lands and wilderness of Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elise Thatcher. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
Carbondale's Stacey Bernot has been a public servant for more than a decade. Now she's leaving the town's Board of Trustees. Elise spoke with Bernot about what prompted the move.
We have been presented with an opportunity to live outside of town, and it's a decision that my family and I made together as a whole. Timing isn't always something that works in everyone's favor, but the time was right. My kids especially were really wanting to make this move.
And you're hesitant to talk too much about this because this is your personal life, but it sounds like you weren't actively looking to leave town.
Correct. My husband and I have owned our home in Carbondale for almost 16 years now. Obviously, people that know my background know I'm fairly established in the community, and so this wasn't something where we were shopping for things in the market. It was just a situation that presented itself and made the most sense for all of us. You know, on the other hand, when people say, well, geez, then why couldn't you have waited till you finished your term? And my family has sacrificed a great deal, especially in the last 12 years of me being in elected office, 4 years prior to that being on the Parks and Rec Commission and a ton of volunteering with coaching and other things in between. And if my family says this is the right time for them, I obviously choose them.
Is your move and ultimately living outside of town limits, not being within the boundaries to serve as mayor, is that part of a larger trend with the cost of housing?
Not necessarily in my circumstance. And so I'm glad you asked that question because I wanted to help clarify that as best as possible. We all are well aware that the high cost of living here is causing folks to make choices and difficult choices, and one that every community in the region is grappling with at this time, how to best address it. But in my particular situation, that isn't applicable. I think the biggest issue going forward for the board is, you know, how do you continue to manage those expectations, those levels of service, the desires for new amenities, knowing that we have finite resources, coupled with the fact of how do you retain the character of Carbondale? And I'm not talking about the buildings, because to me it's never been about the buildings, it's the people. And so how do we keep that diversity?
Well, Mayor Bernot, thanks for taking the time to talk.
Thanks, Elise. I appreciate it.
Freshly elected trustee Dan Richardson is now also leading the town's Board of Trustees. Elise spoke with Richardson about what it was like finding out former mayor Stacey Bernot had to step down.
Well, when I first heard the news, I was very surprised and then a little bummed because I was really looking forward to working with Stacey. I think she has done a fantastic job, and I was looking forward to maybe learning a little and just getting into a groove with the new board. When it became obvious that there needed to be an acting mayor in the short term, I had to think about it a little bit, but I felt like it was something I could do if the remainder of the trustees felt the same. So it was a relatively easy decision.
And tell me about your leadership style. How will you be balancing getting to know town? You're a newly elected trustee. That's mm-hmm. one step, but also being in charge to a certain extent. How will you go about balancing that?
You know, I've given it a lot of thought, and I see the role of mayor, particularly in Carbondale, as a facilitator. There's a lot happening in Carbondale. The town is just a partner in everything that makes Carbondale what it is, but it's a significant partner. So I see one of my primary roles is just helping everyone else do the best they can be, and whether that's helping a nonprofit or helping businesses, helping town staff, and certainly helping the Board of Trustees make decisions and think strategically. So I feel somewhat fortunate in that I can come in with fresh eyes and be and hopefully play that role as facilitator.
And is that a little different than what you had envisioned just as a trustee?
It is. When you're a trustee, you can focus more on the issues. You know, we talked about housing and, you know, allowing businesses to thrive. And now as acting mayor, it's a little bit different. Like I said, you have to be a facilitator, and that's, I think, a lot more work than maybe a lot of people think it is. And Stacey was a master at that. And so I hope to follow in her footsteps in a lot of ways and be that facilitator.
Well, Dan Richardson, thanks for taking the time to talk.
Thanks, Elise.
Despite widespread support from Democrats and Republicans, as well as legislative leaders, two separate attempts to move Colorado back to a presidential primary failed in the final days of the state legislature. As Capitol correspondent Benta Berkland reports, some lawmakers are still trying to figure out what went wrong.
After less than perfect caucuses in March, with overcrowding and confusion, it looked like the time was right to pass a primary bill. There was momentum, all the key players were on board, including county clerks and the Secretary of State, but even that wasn't enough.
It's a lot of work that went into it. It's frustrating that we couldn't make it happen.
That's Democratic Senate Minority Leader Lucia Guzman of Denver. She was one of the sponsors of a bipartisan bill that cleared the House. It would have added a primary for the presidential contest while keeping the caucus system for everything else.
What happened on March 1st at our caucuses is not all right.
Democratic Senator Matt Jones of Louisville backed the bill.
At my caucus, I know people were disenfranchised. I like caucuses. But we've outgrown them.
But Senate Republicans on the State Veterans and Military Affairs Committee felt it was rushed and defeated the measure. Here's Republican Senator Jerry Sonnenberg of Sterling.
We have time to get this right, to put people together to figure out what this process looks like.
Republican Party Chairman Steve House testified in favor of the bill, which would have automatically sent mail ballots to registered Democrats and Republicans, while others would have had the option of temporarily affiliating with the party. House said the bill would have helped him make the pitch to the National Party for Colorado to replace Nevada as the first Western state in the Republican presidential primary.
It's also the idea that Colorado citizens get more engaged early on, right? They start to look at who the presidential candidates are and how they're going to address their issues or their needs.
Lawmakers also withdrew a separate Republican primary bill. Unlike the House version, it would have prevented unaffiliated voters from participating. Now it will likely be up to voters to decide the issue. Various ballot proposals are being considered for this fall to add a presidential primary in Colorado and open current primaries up to unaffiliated voters. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
This week's Aspen City Council work session focused on free market residential units. They're cited as the impetus for the current moratorium on any new development downtown. Allison spoke with Community Development Director Jessica Garrow about why this issue is getting a lot of attention.
In your memo, we refer to, and I know one very prominent example, times when the free market residential component, those owners have been able to kind of dictate what happens in the rest of the building. How many other examples of those kind of conflicts do we have?
Some of it is perception, but others are true experience. And so the Motherlode building, for instance, sat vacant for many years. It has two residential units in it, and it was a long time before that commercial space was actually occupied. And that really had a deadening effect on that particular block. We see it in other buildings downtown where the residential component maybe finishes before the commercial component does. And there's concerns about what happens when those free market residential owners start occupying, and what are they able to do in terms of internal condo declarations, which the city can't really have a role in. And so while things may be permitted in a zone district, depending on how those internal documents that the city is not a party to are structured, it could really limit the types of commercial uses that are allowed.
To get into the history a little bit, and maybe even into theory a little bit, we should have mixed use in order to have vibrancy.
It is important, and the Aspen Community Plan talks about the importance of having residential downtown, but it talks about it in terms of affordable housing and the importance of having local working residents near where they work, really just part of that vibrant community. When infill began, what we underestimated was the power, the buying power of folks who can get in and build those free market residential units and how that impacts the commercial spaces.
So you would be able to differentiate in a resolution or something that no free market, but it is okay to still allow affordable units or after managed units.
Yeah, so right now in the downtown zone districts where free market residential is not allowed, you can build affordable housing. Part of the moratorium is, should that ban on free market residential units that currently exists in the immediate downtown commercial core and C1 zones, should that be extended to mixed use, neighborhood commercial, and SCI? So that's a decision that City Council can make and we'll be discussing on Tuesday.
You are listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Allison Bektesh. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Also online, you can sign up for Aspen Public Radio's new ForkFed digital newsletter. ForkFed comes out every Friday morning, updating you on the week's news in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond.
Oil and gas companies pay a tax to the state for the minerals they extract. Colorado then gives some of that money to local communities affected by drilling. But a recent state Supreme Court ruling says companies have been overpaying these severance taxes, and now Colorado owes the industry tens of millions of dollars. Benta Berkland has more.
At issue are deductions companies can claim from the total taxes they owe. In this case, it's transportation, manufacturing, and processing costs. The court says the state wasn't allowing companies to also deduct the cost of capital. That's money companies could have earned if they'd invested it in other things.
Had they been taking that deduction all along, we wouldn't have the revenue right now that we're restricting.
Democratic Senator Pat Stebman of Denver is sponsoring a bill that would refund the money.
We wouldn't have collected it in the first place.
Stebman and other lawmakers face a midnight deadline on Wednesday to figure out just how to pay back the roughly $115 million.
I mean, it's very clear in the statute. You can deduct these costs.
That's Stan Dempsey, the president of the Colorado Petroleum Association. He says he's pleased with the court's unanimous decision against the state in favor of BP America. the company that filed the lawsuit. Going forward, the ruling means Colorado's severance taxes would drop by roughly 13% each year, and that's where things get especially tricky.
The state's in a pickle, and we get that.
Kevin Balmer is with the Colorado Municipal League, which represents cities and towns across the state. The ruling means Colorado would suspend nearly $50 million in grants that would otherwise go to local communities to address impacts associated with energy development.
That's jobs, that's economy, that's roads and bridges, that's all of these things that are intended to mitigate impacts, and they're not going to be mitigated.
Severance tax money also flows to the Department of Natural Resources for things like infrastructure and water projects. But instead of reducing that money in the future, Democrats in the House want to change state law to make it illegal for companies to deduct capital expenses going forward. Speaker of the House Dickie Lee Hollinghorst is a sponsor.
This is intended to be a very simple solution to take the enforcement of this tax back to what had been interpreted by the Department of Revenue prior to this court case.
Hollinghorst's measure cleared its first House committee along party lines, with Republicans like Cole Wist of Centennial voting no.
You mentioned that we're returning the law to what it was, and I don't think that's an accurate statement. I think we're returning the law to what you thought it was. And a unanimous Supreme Court ruled that was incorrect.
Lawmakers only found out about the Supreme Court case in the last several days, even though the decision happened 2 weeks ago. Republican Representative Patrick Neville of Castle Rock and others criticized the Department of Revenue for not notifying lawmakers sooner and failing to understand the underlying law.
I think the problem is with DOR, who continuously got it wrong year after year.
But others, such as Democratic Representative Mike Foote of Lafayette, say the law should change because the tax is already inadequate.
Not just severance taxes, but the overall tax rate when you combine the tax liabilities of Colorado is still much lower than neighboring states, much lower than Wyoming, much lower than North Dakota, much lower than Oklahoma.
Both measures are moving forward at rapid speed. The Democratic bill is expected to fail in the GOP-controlled Senate, so companies would be allowed to take the capital tax deduction. And this won't be the last issue regarding severance taxes. The slowdown in oil and gas drilling means the state's severance taxes are already dropping, so there's less money to go around next year. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
Andrea Buer is a photojournalist who calls Aspen home. 15 years ago, she saw firsthand the effects of the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center. The pictures she took there will be on display at the National September 11th Memorial and Museum in New York City. Buer spoke with Aspen Public Radio's Patrick Fort about her experiences at Ground Zero.
So over the course of the 2.5 months that you were there, was there ever a moment where you had trouble removing yourself from the situation, being able to, you know, just be there and be a professional and take pictures and just for a second put the camera down and kind of be there?
I think that the experience at Ground Zero, the experience of being in New York and at Ground Zero, I actually felt more comfortable being at the site than I did anywhere else in New York. Like so many other people that worked there, I felt a part of something there. I felt like I was a participant and that I was doing something which was, you know, documenting for history. So as far as putting down my camera, we did put our cameras away whenever there was a body removed from the site. And the firefighters and the police both had special ceremonies that they did when they found one of their own. And I would put my camera away. I never documented any of that. I just felt that was too personal.
And when you see those moments, what was that like, seeing that and experiencing that?
Experiencing that was very sacred. And I never lost sight of that when I was working at Ground Zero. I never lost sight that that it wasn't just a body or a person, it was somebody's loved one. And I didn't want to create any more hurt or any more pain by photographing a body part and having somebody wonder if that was a family member or a friend.
This much time later, did you think that the photos you had taken then would have the impact that they did, or this much exposure?
When I first got to Ground Zero, there was still media access to the site. And so I knew my photographs would be important, but it wasn't until Giuliani cut off the media access that I recognized that I was photographing for history, and how important, I guess, the images would be. And it was, you know, on one hand, it was an incredible honor, and on the other hand, it was this huge responsibility.
The Arts and Culture Desk at Aspen Public Radio is funded by the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation with a mission to support the arts, community, and outreach. Aspen Words has announced its summer writers in residence. Patrick Fort has more.
Sunil Yapa is the headliner for this year's group of writers. Yapa's debut novel, Your Heart is the Muscle, the Size of a Fist, has received high acclaim. The Wall Street Journal, Chicago Tribune, and BuzzFeed all listed it as one of their most anticipated books of the year. Bruce Handy and Helen Schulman will be coming to the Valley in August. The two writers have had their work appear in the New York Times. Currently, Schulman is a tenured professor of writing at the New School. Handy has also worked in television, working as a writer on Saturday Night Live. Paul Greiner, Tom Bowman, and Jenny Price will also be visiting this summer. The writers spend a month in Woody Creek working on their current projects. There are readings and talks with each resident author, and they also appear in Valley schools and at private events.
In the closing days of the legislative session, Republicans in the Senate defeated one of the governor's top priorities. As Bent of Brooklyn reports, the bill would have reclassified a fee that hospitals pay, worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
Hospitals use the money to leverage matching federal dollars to help pay for low-income patients. That money also counts as revenue under the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights. Democrats want to reclassify the fee so it wouldn't force the state to refund money to voters over the Tabor limit. Republican Senator Owen Hill of Colorado Springs was one of those who said not so fast.
This becomes a moral question for us that we failed to address the long-term structure and whether or not we can live within our means.
Republicans who defeated the bill also said it would violate the spirit of Tabor because it would lead to unchecked government growth and prevent refunds from going to taxpayers in the next several years. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Elise Thatcher.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. To hear the show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. A panel of journalists join news director Carolyn Zachariasen to provide analysis, insight, and context to the week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.